products. Over the past few decades, Western women have become more interested in Eastern cosmetics and vice versa. As noted before, it's all about achieving an impossible ideal of perfect skin, or as it's known in Korea, glass skin. The newest way to display health and thus wealth and superiority. Glass skin is this idea of transparent and translucent skin, according to Peach and Lily's founder, Alicia Yoon. It's a sign of youthfulness, and it's one of the most strived-for qualities in Korea, Yoon told the Malay Mail Online. It also means more products. Glass skin is supposedly achieved by exfoliating, one product, then moisturizing with an intense serum, two, a face mask, three, and a cream, four. The Korean ideal of small pores and looking naturally perfect is part of the new complex beauty ideal also being leveled against American women. And since Korean beauty regimens require an average of 10 separate steps to achieve results, stores from the high end to the chain are moving a lot more products. The drive for perfect skin is also making a lot of money for the Korean brands. For beauty products, it used to be that French stuff was tops. Now we want something newer and even more involved. We can't talk about Korean beauty without discussing the shocking amount of plastic surgery that exists in Korea as well. Sure, it might be about glass skin and being pure and natural, but a lot of the time, that means going under the knife to achieve this impossible ideal. The most popular plastic surgery in Korea is a double eyelid procedure to make eyes appear larger, rounder, and more Western. This has been going on for decades. Around the world, South Korea ranks third in the largest number of total face and head procedures, behind Brazil, number one, and the U.S., number two. South Korea accounts for a bit over 8% of all face and head procedures, with a fixation on what's called a small face, a narrow and, again, more Western-looking face. A 2015 New Yorker profile highlighted the proliferation of plastic surgery in South Korea. By some estimates, the country has the highest rate of plastic surgery per capita in the world. It's also young Korean women. Between one-third and one-fifth of all women in Seoul have had plastic surgery. And for women in their 20s, it might be more than 50%. The wave of plastic surgery began after the Korean War, after American occupational forces offered free reconstructive surgeries, and David Ralph Millard, the chief plastic surgeon for the U.S. Marine Corps, perfected the blepharoplasty, the eyelid surgery noted above. American celebrities and other influencers are also crazy for K-beauty, from Drew Barrymore and the Hanicure mask to Emma Stone using a lip mask. But the converse is not the same in Korea. For marketing beauty products in Korea itself, our Kardashian ideal doesn't work. Kendall Jenner, considered a supermodel in America and the face of countless beauty and fashion spreads, was a dud when she headlined the Estee Lauder marketing efforts in Asia. There are lessons from the success of Korean beauty that can be a map for other beauty trends and brands. When it comes to politics and policy, it's possible that cosmetics from other countries could become a political football. In China, a ban on Korean cosmetics ended up being the Chinese response to some U.S. actions in South Korea. China banned imports of 19 Korean cosmetics products amid rising tensions over Korea's decision to allow the deployment of a U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, THAAD, battery here, according to the South China Morning Post. It's also unclear whether or not these products work. They aren't subjected to some of America's testing requirements. Korean beauty products are in their first wave of export to America, so it's possible that Korean plastic surgery will be right around the corner. Shortly, we could find Westerners heading to Korea in droves for surgery holidays, as medical tourism to other countries has grown. American women will also keep shelling out, possibly even more, for beauty. South Korean women spend twice as much of their income on beauty products and makeup than their American counterparts, according to an article by the BBC. The market is also expanding beyond just women. American men may become the next beauty-hungry category, with K-beauty targeting beard treatments or pores for men's skincare. South Korean men spend the most on skincare of any around the world. The Koreans have been incredibly on target in understanding global and American marketplaces. Samsung is the only company other than Apple able to dominate the smartphone marketplace, and now Korean companies have boldly entered a quintessentially American marketplace with great success. They tend to study what we do here in America. Increasingly, we may have to study what South Koreans are working on to be better marketers and to catch the next wave of trends. 33. Modern Annie Oakleys. Women in America are better educated, better paid, the majority in college, and buying more guns. Annie Oakley was perhaps America's best-known woman sharpshooter, and she had a vision. I would like to see every woman know how to handle guns as naturally as they know how to handle babies. This hasn't happened quite yet, but strides have been made. The gender gap in guns is closing. It seemed a little counterintuitive when the NRA launched a TV ad featuring American conservative political commentator Dana Loesch. But the ad proved a somewhat controversial success at getting attention for her cause. Loesch believes in the Second Amendment, loves her guns, and packs convention halls at the NRA's annual meetings. She also believes that women, just as much as men, should get out there and shoot. Says Loesch, "Women have always had the right to bear arms. We have had the right to bear arms before we had the right to vote. Women must use their rights. The quickest way to lose them is to not use them." Getting good numbers on gun ownership is difficult, as people in the same household often share a gun. The exact number of gun-owning women is hard to pin down as a result. Two studies from this decade showed that 12% of women individually own guns. The Pew Research Center put that rate at 22% in 2017, and a Harris poll reported the figure as 18% in late 2015. And while the figure itself may be fuzzy, multiple studies agree that the number of women gun owners is on the rise. Gun manufacturers have taken notice, and at first they responded with guns of different colors. A pink pistol isn't nearly enough, though. Not only do women gun owners like the military-style look, they also care more about the shape and feel of the gun, not the color scheme. The growth in female gun ownership coincides with women pouring into the military and joining the police force, professions where they are handling guns regularly and need to be proficient in firearms. Women were 17% of active-duty military in 2015, up from 12% in 1990. And while one study found that women make up only 6% to 8% of police officers, in smaller communities, women were found to make up more than 20% of the police force. These new Annie Oakleys, according to hobbyist magazine Guns and Ammo, are younger, less urban, and buying most often for protection. The number one gun of choice of women is a semi-automatic handgun, followed by a good old-fashioned shotgun. Half of all women gun ownership is in the South, while far fewer women in the West own guns. Compared to other race and gender cohorts, African American women had the highest percent increase in concealed carry permits in Texas from 2000 to 2016. Yet less than a third of black families view gun ownership positively. It's more out of fear, as recent police shootings and an uptick in racial tension drive these gun sales. They're also pushed upward by the fact that more women are living alone longer and more women are single parents. Of course, guns are a bit like nuclear weapons. The idea is not to use them but to frighten your opponent. Every day, according to the Department of Justice, there are 200 DGUs, defensive gun uses. In those instances, others back down because they see that they could be facing the barrel of a gun. The idea, especially for women, is not to use the guns by shooting them, but to use them for deterrence and self-defense. The new Annie Oakleys also differ from their male counterparts in that only a third of them play violent video games, watch television shows or movies about guns, hunting, or shooting sports, or visit websites on those topics. In essence, while these women might own guns, they don't necessarily buy into gun culture in the same way men do. Female owners are also less likely to socialize over guns. 6 in 10 female gun owners report that most of their friends do not own guns, while 54% of men gun owners say most of their friends also own guns. Women also buy their first gun at an older age than men do. On average, women report buying their first gun at age 27, while men typically get theirs at 19. Men are also 43% more likely to keep their guns loaded, compared to 29% of women. But women are equally as likely as men to carry their weapons with them outside of their homes. 26% for both genders. Some women see guns as an issue of empowerment. Antonia Okafor, as a young black conservative gun owner, said in her New York Times opinion piece, Why I Bring My Gun to School, I felt empowered to be holding a tool that could protect me physically, and I was determined to learn how to use it responsibly. It was a relief to know that I could shoot if I had to, even though I would never use my gun unless it was a last means of self-defense. According to statistics from the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, sexual assaults occur against Americans every 98 seconds on average. And those are just the ones that are reported. 80% of those women are under 30 years old. In 2016, Marie Claire magazine ran a survey of 5,000 women in conjunction with the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and found that 18% of women in the study have become more interested in owning a gun, and 13% have gone to a gun shooting range. While most women are not interested in gun sport, more women are enjoying it. The New York Times concluded that target shooting and hunting by women went up nearly 50% from 2001 to 2011, with over 5 million women participating annually. And according to data from the NRA, there has been an 85% increase in women who hunt, a signal to gun manufacturers and shooting ranges to diversify their offerings. Gun sales to women have risen in concert. In a survey last year by the National Shooting Sports Foundation, 73% of gun dealers said the number of female customers had gone up since 2011. Politically, if you own a gun, you are likely a Republican. If you are a woman and own a gun, your chances are increased that you will be a Republican, but it's not necessarily a sure thing. Both men and women gun owners in America say gun ownership is part of their freedoms. For women, it's 70% of gun owners and 77% for men, according to Pew. The new Annie Oakleys tend to be more open to the debate around the Second Amendment. In general, women are more supportive of policies that might restrict their right to bear arms. Over half of Republican women and Republican-leaning women also support banning assault weapons, 60%, whereas only a third of their male counterparts are interested in bringing that law back. In the Washington, D.C. area, an overwhelmingly liberal area, a group called the Shooting Divas of DMV goes to the range together, and even have childcare worked out for those participating. More women are banding together around their enjoyment of guns, and it will likely influence key shooting-related industries like hunting and target ranges to be more women-friendly. From the way the equipment is made to the spaces for people to enjoy using guns, this will all be transformed with women in mind. Most gun range owners are male and are set up to cater to men. Gun manufacturers have typically adapted their designs to the size of men's hands, and they are already adjusting their products. A brand called Gun Goddess now sells American women gun-related paraphernalia. Whether it's women starting to own their own firing ranges or to continue refining new equipment and apparel built for a woman's body, there are many ways, big and small, in which the industry will be shaped by its newest enthusiasts. The new Annie Oakleys are a large part of the National Rifle Association's fan base. even the hiring of a woman spokesperson, and a lightning rod one at that, in Dana Loesch, is significant. And Loesch also has a say in policy. About a year ago, she became the NRA's special advisor on women's policy. The NRA recognizes the money being poured into the gun industry by American women and has held its own concealed carry fashion show for both men and women. Of note, nearly all the models on Pinterest boards for concealed carry or modeling certain concealed carry clothing are white. That is likely to change. As previously noted, the largest growing subset of women with guns in America are black. Gun culture among American women is also increasingly prevalent in popular culture, from television to movies, and not just among conservative women. From Mindy Kaling's character on The Mindy Project to Robin from How I Met Your Mother, women in sitcoms are discussing and keeping guns. Both shows are situational comedies, not intense dramas with any violence. We also see more heroines and femme fatales, a long-standing trope, in film, from gun-wielding women like Lara Croft in the new Tomb Raider movie to Charlize Theron in Atomic Blonde. We are getting more used to seeing women with guns, beyond playing the roles of cop or hit woman. This is also becoming part of the draw, visible in the marketing campaigns of films like Atomic Blonde, which featured a poster of Theron holding a gun. Also influential off-screen are American women like Sarah Palin and Joni Ernst, well known for toting weapons. Women have come a long way in the gun professions and gun ownership. The change has affected the marketplace, politics, and self-defense, even as the push for more gun control laws has ramped up following recent mass shootings, gun ownership is just as prevalent as ever, now boosted by the new Annie Oakleys. 34. Armchair Preppers. Two very different events have led to a revival of survivalism: 9/11 and the banking crisis of 2009. Both man-made. On top of that, there was Hurricane Katrina, the storms of 2017, and the Mexico City earthquake, all of which rekindled fear of nature. These terrifying events have prompted a new group of Americans, already in a pessimistic state of mind, to wonder what they would do to survive if the worst happened. Part of this is reflected in the surge of gun purchases. Another part is visible in the allure of holding gold and silver in case of economic collapse. Add to this brew the tensions with North Korea and ISIS, along with TV shows like The Last Ship and Designated Survivor, which speculate on what life could be like if another bubonic plague hit, or if terrorists blew up our government, and you can understand why the conversation at every dinner table might eventually turn to what the family should do in the event of a national or regional emergency. The armchair preppers are people who are stuffing money and gold under their mattresses again, building safe rooms in their houses, sticking guns in hidden parts of their closets, getting their bug-out bags ready, and waiting. Americans in fear stockpiling cans of food for the apocalypse isn't exactly new. Look at the 1950s, with its bomb shelters and kids hiding under desks in schools. It's movies that reflected the fear and uncertainty we felt at that time. The Doomsday Clock, created in 1947 and maintained by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, is a symbol of this fear of the end, from nuclear war to climate change. Now we don't just have to face the threat of war with North Korea. Although in a recent poll, 69% of Americans feared it, we have the world gone mad with unprecedented natural disasters. The doomsday clock currently sits at its closest ever to midnight reading, just 2.5 minutes away. So it's no surprise that the fear of the 50s would at some point meet the ease of the digital age. You can flip to a website like the New Survivalist and get a full checklist of everything you need to do to be prepared for the next disaster. They have guns, clothes, water, food, money, batteries, and a host of other items ready to go, and locations where they will go to survive, complete with weapons cache. There are luxury companies for armchair preppers ready and waiting, if you will, to serve the current fears. Preppy, a New York startup, sells $5,000 disaster preparedness bags and proclaims that they make the best for when the worst happens. Most households are underprepared for even the simplest and most common emergencies, let alone game enders. Homes or apartments typically have a lot of required fire sensors, but not a lot of training on what to do if one goes off, or even how to get down from the second floor when the stairs are blocked. Like American companies that are almost always unprepared for hacks, the average American family lives on optimism when it comes to their own future. They think the government is going to take care of everything. The experience so far of most disasters is that they are, for the most part, right about that. We have had regional or island-wide disasters, but the breakdown of civil order or chain of command has been short-lived. That said, the power and internet grids have revealed themselves to still be a lot more vulnerable to complete takedown, and can remain down for weeks or months. According to Yahoo Finance, as many as 3.7 million Americans would consider themselves armchair preppers, a little more than 1% of the population. They are typically fit. Many are former military and often anti-government in perspective. The new survivalist site features a quote from Ron Paul that says, "Trust yourself, not the government." Over 30,000 people attended a recent prepper convention. The new breed of high-tech, high-powered armchair preppers is quite different from those more downscale bunker-in-the-woods types, as Evan Osnos of The New Yorker reported in an in-depth look at doomsday preppers. In recent years, survivalism has expanded to more affluent quarters, taking root in Silicon Valley and New York City, among technology executives, hedge fund managers, and others in their economic cohort. They feature Steve Huffman, the founder and CEO of Reddit, who underwent laser eye surgery not only to see better, but also because he hoped it will improve his odds of surviving a disaster, whether natural or man-made. He believed that glasses and contact lenses will be almost impossible to get if there is a disaster. On a global scale, Osnos observed that many a prepper is purchasing real estate in New Zealand. Thousands of Americans registered with New Zealand's immigration authorities in the week after Donald Trump was elected, starting down the path toward becoming a Kiwi if the world is flipped upside down. But Trump hasn't been the only factor. Wealthy paranoiacs from across the globe are buying up land in this remote country, because it has adequate resources and is protected from short-term global warming. In the past 6 years, Osnos reported, nearly 1,000 foreigners have acquired residency there under programs that mandate certain types of investment of at least $1 million. New Zealanders do not appear to be thrilled about this influx of armchair preppers either. Closer to home, Revolutionary Realty is one such place that specializes in real estate for those moving to the American Redoubt, a term coined by survivalist author James Wesley, Rawls, the comma is deliberate, that refers to an area of the Pacific Northwest including Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and the eastern parts of Washington and Oregon. Hundreds of properties in the American Redoubt have been sold within the last couple of years. People are drawn by specific off-the-grid features. At least two water sources, alternative energy sources such as solar panels, secure storage space for several years' worth of supplies, and a defensible location away from city centers and main roads. A scan of the ads on prepper sites shows a market for the obvious: seeds to generate food, guns, gold, and lots of emergency kits. The vendors look smallish and the ads, by and large, amateur. The survival industry is still in its infancy, and no big brands have really moved into the area despite its growing size. But there is real potential for larger forces to enter, and for the industry to explode into the mainstream. Outside of the intense prepper marketplace and the super-rich clients, there is room in a typical household to improve their readiness for what's most likely to happen in their area, i.e. floods in Miami or Louisiana, and earthquakes in California. That would mean a kit that could get you through a few days without food, water, money, power, or internet service. The Tesla Powerwall, for instance, is likely to revolutionize power preparedness for people who don't have or want to have a generator. Today, we are also more likely to have the world's first digital disaster. The most likely scenario would be a civilization-threatening cyber attack that takes down brokerage houses, banks, and maybe the entire stock market. Such an event that wiped out the monetary system could cause widespread panic. The IRAs and brokerage accounts that today hold most non-real estate wealth in the country could become locked up or worse. Such a financial disaster would destroy the economy, the ability to trade, and bring the monetary system to a halt. It would most likely be the surest way for a foreign power to create chaos. The implication of this is that it might not be such a bad idea to have some gold and silver at home after all. The armchair preppers are part attitude, part real preparedness. Most people don't expect to be able to make it on their own if everything collapses. But most people want to be able to survive a terrorist attack, a limited nuclear exchange, or the next big flood or earthquake with some higher degree of control. Plus, fear of monetary collapse is always underappreciated. These armchair preppers may seem like kooks to some, but their fears are probably more justified, or at least worth considering, than we appreciate. Section 5. Politics. 35. Old economy voters. 36. Happy pessimists. 37. Closet conservatives. 38. Impressionable elites revisited. 39. Militant dreamers revisited. 40. Newest Americans. 41. Couch potato voters. 35. Old economy voters. I would not have predicted the twists and turns that the politics of the manufacturing class have taken since I worked on successful campaigns for Bill Clinton in 1996 and Tony Blair in 2005. Both of those leaders won because they convinced their respective working classes that the future, for their jobs and in general, lay in the new economy and greater globalization of trade. Blair and Clinton were champions of the new professional class, but they held on to their working class bases against the more elitist Tories and Republicans. In the mid-1990s in the U.S. and the U.K., manufacturing jobs stabilized as the new economy was taking root. That was the time to enact policies that ensured tech centers and other potential boons of the new economy could take hold across the country. President Clinton ran a new markets tour with tax incentive programs whose intent was to make sure that the new economy reached more areas, but it didn't take hold. This effort was way too small to counteract the forces that had been set in motion. Following NAFTA and the start of the new millennium, manufacturing jobs plummeted. From 2000, after a period of gaining manufacturing jobs, they essentially collapsed. By 2010, these jobs shrunk in America from nearly 18 million to 11 million. The same thing happened in the UK, where manufacturing jobs dropped from 4 million in 2000 to 2.6 million in 2010. This was the single most devastating period for manufacturing jobs, probably since the Great Depression. In a very short time, millions of people lost their livelihoods, and Presidents Bush and Obama all but ignored the problem, as the overall economy was creating jobs. Pressure was building, but no one was paying much attention in the rush to create a big tech economy. At that same time, several other major trends were compounding the loss of these jobs. A lot of American kids were leaving their hometowns, say, in coal mining country, for education and jobs in urban areas, a movement that both compounded economic problems and split up families in destructive ways. The busiest travel day of the year is the day before Thanksgiving, because people are traveling simply to be with their families, now typically spread out across the country. These were also years of significant influx of immigration. While there were 31 million immigrants living in the U.S. in 2000, by 2015, this population had grown to more than 43 million. Similarly, in the U.K., the foreign-born population went from 5.3 million in 2004 to 9.1 million in 2016. Economic and military crises, including the war in Syria, brought millions of refugees to continental Europe, a phenomenon keenly observed by EU skeptics in the UK. The last notable trend was a period of wage stagnation. The $54,398 median household income in the US in 2014 was around $4,000 lower than it was in 2000, although it has since increased. Median income in the UK rose during the same period, but at limited levels, from £22,000 to £26,000, and many still felt left behind in the new economy. Loss of manufacturing jobs due to NAFTA, kids leaving and not coming back, an influx of immigration and wage stagnation for those who had jobs, these hit all at once. While most immigrants settled on the coasts, the fear of immigration and its effects was enough to create an electoral tinderbox. Then Trump came along and lit the match. He ran against both the Democrats and the pro-trade, pro-immigration Republican elites. A recent New York Times article put it succinctly. Like Mr. Obama, Mr. Trump ran against the establishment. His views on immigration, trade, China, crime, guns, and Islam all had considerable appeal to white working-class Democratic voters, according to Pew Research data. It was a far more appealing message than old Republican messages about abortion, same-sex marriage, and the social safety net. The left would like to say that it is racism that drove the largely white working class to revolt, but many of those same voters cast their ballots for Barack Obama, and before that for Bill Clinton. What drove them was largely economics first, then the interplay of trade, immigration, law and order, and the sectoral dislocation of their communities. These changes were deep and profound, and they accelerated in the 10 to 15 years before the Trump election. When I worked in the UK in 2005, the opposition's consultant, Linton Crosby, had come from Australia, where fanning the immigration issue was a tried-and-true strategy. He tried to run that same playbook in the UK in 2005, but Britain was not ready for the harsher angle, and Tony Blair won with a moderate view on immigration. Fast forward, though, and you see the diverging microtrends at work. On the one hand, London elects Sadiq Khan, the first Muslim mayor of a major Western city. On the other, the countryside roundly approves Brexit, with growing anti-immigration sentiment a critical part of that vote. While London has embraced the new economy and globalization, every other major region other than Scotland and Northern Ireland voted for leave rather than remain. And just when it looked like the Labour Party was going to be impossible to beat after Blair's decade as Prime Minister, that party is now fractured and has been out of power across two election cycles now. The same voter groups, the old economy voters, on two continents stood up and reasserted their power, putting major stakes into the heart of progressive plans. The UK isn't alone in the rise of the old economy voter. In France, we're also seeing the rise of National Front, a hard right party. Support is drawn largely from non-college educated Catholic men and those who oppose engagement in the global economy. While Marine Le Pen lost the election, polls show she had 40% support among French youth ages 18 to 24. A surprising finding, considering France is traditionally known for its leftist youth movements. I don't think that this microtrend, with the stabilization once again of manufacturing jobs, will last decades as a pivotal vote. The numbers are diminishing in the long run, but they could again be powerful in the next round of elections. More important, they are not to be dismissed as deplorable. These Americans are hard-working, family and religion-oriented people who have had their ears boxed by globalization and technology. The elites ignored them at their peril, and Trump filled the void. There are also some basic immutable facts from elementary economics that can't be ignored. Bring in millions of low-skilled workers from any part of the world, and the wages of the existing working class members will be squeezed, regardless of their religion, ethnicity, or nationality. Open your borders to trade without a border equalization tax, and manufacturing jobs will be shipped overseas. This does not mean it is or is not the right strategy. It means that some existing people will be damaged to a greater extent than has been realized. When too much power and money went to the cities, the rural areas worked to wrest it back. The answer is not to try to revive the old economy, though there is no question that we can drive better trade bargains that cost fewer jobs. The answer has got to be to distribute the tools and the jobs related to the new economy to every region of the country, and to spend what it takes to get this done. We certainly need to provide new economy tax credits that work in the areas that have less than their fair share of these jobs. It may not be practical to put all the engineering jobs in Ohio, but we may well be able to put a lot of Amazon warehouses there, and at least some of the engineering. Another thing we need to do is figure a way for people in the cities and the suburbs to have a better understanding of the rest of the country. We need to encourage every rising cloistered college student to take a trip one summer, not to Israel or France, but across America for 6 weeks. We have become so siloed that Americans simply don't know America. Finally, we have to stop the depopulating of our rural areas. It just does not make sense as a country, when these areas are so rich in culture, in land, and in resources, to let them atrophy any further. We need to make them the most desirable areas in the country for people to settle down in, and make it easier for kids to stay and build good lives there. 36. Happy Pessimists. The economy is cratering. My kids will never do as well as I did. The country is headed over a cliff. Washington is broken. Racism and neo-Nazis are rampant. Free speech is dead. College graduates end up with hamburger flipper jobs. And so on and so on. Something has happened over the last decade in America. The most optimistic, can-do country has become mired in endless pessimism and negativity. Try to say that America has never been so prosperous, or that its middle class has never had so much opportunity, and you may get laughed out of a room. Today, nearly two-thirds of young Americans enroll in college, and if they graduate, they earn significantly more money. Women are earning more than men in major metropolitan areas, and are the majority of students in colleges and professional schools. Wages have gone up, especially when adjusted for inflation and employer subsidies like employer-provided health care. Inflation is low. Healthcare coverage is at an all-time high. Costs of basic middle-class goods like energy and housing have gone down. And political infighting, rough as it is, doesn't compare to the open warfare and mass protests of the 1960s. But many Americans believe this can't possibly be true. They believe the worst about America and are fueling a downward spiral of pessimism increasingly out of sync with the overall statistics of the country, and even their assessments of their own lives. Half of respondents ages 18 to 29 in a recent Harvard Institute of Politics survey said they considered the American dream alive and well for them personally. Half of them said it was dead as a doornail. The origins of this trend started, I believe, with September 11th. The horrific tragedy was the last time America came together in unity to fight a foe, but the subsequent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite being on a far smaller scale than past wars in Vietnam, Korea, or World War II, dragged down the national psyche. Leadership lost sight of the national goals, and America grew tired of the fight and all its expense in money and lost lives. National morale only worsened with the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. In the 1990s and early 2000s, 70% of Americans were satisfied with the direction things were going in the United States, according to Gallup. Starting in 2005, after Bush's re-election, which coincided with the setbacks in Iraq, the right track slipped below 50%. This right track, wrong track measure has remained below 50% ever since. It is the longest continuous period of the public feeling down about the country that I can find since the modern era of polling began. Americans somehow felt better about the future during and after the Great Depression, even though almost every significant measure of economic and material well-being was much worse. This mood of dissatisfaction and uncertainty means that negativity is what sells products and candidates. The Wesleyan Media Project compiled a chart to show how political advertising has come to reflect these negative attitudes. In 2000, 30% of political ads were negative. In 2004, it was over 40%. In 2008, around 50%. By 2012, over 60%. And in the most recent presidential campaign, 90% of our political ads were negative. Unsurprisingly, public trust in all institutions has declined. Congressional approval is in the teens. Judges, as seen in a Harvard-Harris poll, are believed to rule more on politics than the law. People don't trust traditional media, or social media, even as millennials lap it up. And Washington is viewed as a swamp, with 79% calling the nation's political system corrupt. President Donald Trump played off all this sentiment with his catchphrase, MAGA, Make America Great Again. But after his victory, and in the first 8 months of his presidency, the mood of pessimism has not changed. While some individuals think the country's condition is improving, the overall percentage remains stubbornly in the 30% to 40% range. All this despite the fact that the percentage of people who believe the economy is on the rise has grown for the first time in a decade. This happy pessimist attitude isn't just an American phenomenon, as the lack of trust in institutions is seen across the developed world. There is also a significant divergence in attitudes between the elites, as represented by the top quarter in income, and everyone else. In the U.S., 71% of elites have trust in their institutions, compared to just 40% if you are in the bottom quartile of earnings. This trust gap is also strong in France, Russia, and the UK. It's a phenomenon across the most developed countries, save for Germany, and is in stark contrast to places like Indonesia, Malaysia, and the UAE, where overall trust is high, and the trust gap between income groups is low. The culture of negativity is also reflected in our habits online, where the alt-right, the resistance, and other groups traffic in and respond to a cacophony of negative ads and social media posts. Negative stories are what generate clicks for news organizations as well. Juicy or salacious posts with a negative spin are what get the traffic. You won't believe how these 10 beautiful stars look now. If presented with a negative comment and a positive one, you're going to read the negative comment and remember it. Why is this? According to Donald P. Green, a political science professor at Columbia, negative political ads are more memorable than positive ones, but aren't necessarily more effective. Green says these negative ads still showed that people were no less likely to turn out to the polls or to decide against voting for a candidate who was attacked in an ad. It suggests we are so desensitized to mudslinging and negative ads that they go in one ear and out the other. A study of the media by Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy showed that 91% of mainstream media coverage of the Trump administration has been negative. It's a never-ending stream of negativity hitting our airwaves. American pessimism has become ingrained in our culture for the first time. America's youth remain the most optimistic about their futures, even as they grow up during a period of extreme negativity. But the baby boomers, despite tremendous wealth and prosperity, have turned dark, women even more so than men. This group of people, who are making it and living the American dream, are negative toward America and its institutions, driving the country's new and sour mood. They cut across party lines and even geography. We now have gone from a country that believed we could conquer every adversity to one consumed by cynicism and gullibility. More and more American TV shows have the same plot. Something is wrong in America, and we suspect terrorists abroad. The twist, however, as in Homeland, Designated Survivor, Blindspot, and Quantico, is that the enemy is actually in our midst. We are a country that now responds better to stark negative statements than grand promises, even as technology does more than we ever imagined possible. We are a nation that believes the worst of every institution and company. Happy pessimists are motivated by fear and anger, not hope. The flames are being fueled on the left and the right as political and marketing communicators reluctantly all conclude the same thing. It's now far easier to tear down America than it is to lift it up. These sentiments drive greater skepticism about our military, police, and intelligence operations. They create doubts about our banks, and now growing doubts about our tech companies. They spawn successful TV franchises based on firing people and throwing them off the island. They mean it's easier to stop and stall every new policy by suggesting it will have people dying on the streets. No body politic can really survive without what President Nixon, of all people, called the lift of a driving dream. And America sure doesn't have one right now. Maybe you can be that rare bird, successful in politics and marketing by creating new leadership and turning the mood around. Just look to FDR, who did this in the 1930s. Or you can go with the status quo and cut another negative ad, again ticking the worry bone of the new American pessimists. So far, the happy pessimists are winning out. We are a nation of fears, the most significant one of 2016 being the corruption of government officials, followed pretty widely, by about 20 percentage points, by being attacked on our own soil. Fears in America are ever-changing. In 2016, Americans were afraid of the cost increases of Obamacare. By 2017, the public was more afraid of losing the enhanced health care coverage of Obamacare. With Donald Trump in possession of the nuclear codes, many happy pessimists are fixating on an eternal existential fear, nuclear war. Amid constant tweets and vague threats, those North Korean missiles feel closer than ever. A recent poll reported that 2/3 of Americans are anxious about the country's threat to America, the highest percentage since 2000. Vox reported a whopping 82% of Americans afraid of nuclear war with North Korea. It can feel like new fears come up every day to add to our national pessimism, whether it's another mass shooting, terrorist incident, or potential war. And yet, just a few years ago, when we welcomed the millennium, optimism could not have been higher. World War II and the Holocaust were probably the world's most cataclysmic events, and they dominated our thinking during the last half of the 20th century, a time of soaring optimism. Now, technology and the global economy are achieving a tremendous economic uplift, and the prospect of another global war seems remote. We have dodged virtually every bullet, from pandemic to nuclear war and overpopulation, and yet the public remains more morose than ever. I am hopeful we will see leadership over time that brings back the next morning in America. 37. Closet Conservatives. They might be sitting next to you at work, or maybe they're at the salon, one stylist away, or on the bus sitting beside you, or even across from you at the dinner table. These are America's closet conservatives. They voted for Trump, but hide their real views from you. Perhaps it was the Russians whispering in their ears, but it took many Americans to elect Donald Trump and to vote for a Republican Senate, House of Representatives, and governorships of 36 out of 50 states. Something does not add up. Liberals are everywhere on TV, in the media, in sports, on campuses. How could conservatives possibly outnumber liberals? The answer is the closet conservatives. Closet conservatives talk a good progressive game and blend into liberal areas like Washington, D.C., but they have been driven into the shadows by a society that heaps scorn on their views. Without Fox News reinforcing their views, closet conservatives might go completely stir-crazy. You can't target closet conservatives because, for all practical purposes, they do not have a conservative footprint, and they cover their tracks. In a Harvard Capps-Harris poll conducted last year, nearly 40% of Americans say they are reluctant to reveal their political views to their own family. 60% stay mum at work. Given the gender gap, it is clear that younger men, faced with a pink-hatted girlfriend, are simply not about to confess that they like the bravado of Donald Trump. Husbands who used to be the political lords of the household are now relegated to secretly disagreeing with their spouses while yesing them to their faces. As for closet conservative women, Hillary Clinton has called them traitors to their gender. On TV, the leaders of legions of women are liberal stars such as Madonna and Tina Fey. Yet the most surprising statistic of the last presidential election was that 53% of white women overall, and close to 60% in suburban and rural areas, voted for Donald Trump. These same women also overwhelmingly rejected Barack Obama in the 2012 election in favor of Mitt Romney, and favored Republicans by 22 points in the 2014 midterms. What? That can't be right. Something does not compute. Right. It does not add up. Even when the Republicans have won Congress, the congressional ballot in pre-election polls has generally been 4 or 5 points in the Democrats' favor. This polling disconnect is especially reflected in the differences between telephone polls conducted by live interviewers and online polls. People confronted by others are not as conservative as people clicking away on the internet. Closet conservatives can hide behind a screen, but when asked about their views, they're likely to obscure them in favor of more liberal ones. This comes out particularly in questions about immigration, and the disparity in answers shows that the cohort of closet conservatives is about 5% of the population or more. This suggests that more than 5% of the population, that's more than 15 million people, are more conservative than they are willing to publicly admit. Our polling read on many hot-button issues might then underestimate their true support at the ballot box. Men in particular make up a sizable portion of the closet conservative ranks, perhaps because many might end up sleeping on the couch if they let their political loyalties out into the light. The media reported several divorces after Trump's victory. Wives who couldn't handle the political divide after finding out their beloved voted for him. Recent research indicates that 1 in 10 couples, married or not, have ended their relationships due to a battle over political differences. Some women prefer tall men, some men prefer blondes, but it looks like the new dividing line on dating apps might well be your party affiliation. So much so that the popular dating app Bumble, during the 2016 election season, had filters to say who you were voting for, so you wouldn't waste your time with someone of the opposite party. For younger millennials, this tension over politics is greater. 22% of couples have ended a relationship over political differences. It's no surprise, then, that many closet conservatives would just as soon clam up. Despite most white women voting Republican, especially in the suburbs, peer pressure makes these closet conservative women particularly hard to find. We assume that any educated suburban white woman is going to be a liberal Democrat, but that's not true. That's the essence of the closet conservative. They are not who you expect, and they keep their political views close to the vest. In general, Republicans are more reserved about their beliefs than their Democratic counterparts. The key to figuring out who these closet conservatives are and what they care about is getting them to respond in certain ways. The mode by which these questions are asked, telephone versus survey, matters a lot. So what happened with all the polls that predicted a 2016 election landslide for the Democrats? How did we get it so wrong? Were telephone polls understating support for Trump? The answer was clearly yes. Closet conservatives weren't about to admit who they were voting for, and they were willing to tell someone on the phone what they wanted to hear. Americans in general, when it comes to politics, will default to a pleasing answer versus a real one. A 2005 academic paper revealed that Americans overreported their voting history because it was socially desirable to be a consistent voter. Clearly, social pressures are causing our predictions for elections to be skewed. Many people who said they were voting for Hillary Clinton either were lying or just did not bother to vote. The latter is actually more problematic for polling accuracy. At Nate Silver's 538, the site didn't take into account the non-responses when it came to election polling, which led to a lot of holes in research. Another issue is that the percentage of Americans who are very active politically are actually overreported. As a whole, Americans aren't as enthusiastic about politics as we think. It's a choice group, that is. Another deterrent to expressing political views is that the First Amendment does not extend to the workplace. If you express your conservative political views, say, on Facebook, or give to conservative political causes, you can be fired for views your employer or customers don't like. If you work for a company that sells primarily to urban areas, and you believe in strong borders, you can be outed on social media and become the subject of a consumer boycott. While Congress can't make your actions illegal, your employer may still fire you. This is one big reason why closet conservatives don't make their views known at work. All of which underscores the importance of the secret ballot in letting people express their real views, and highlights the danger of governing by polls. Vote by mail has dangers because organizers and spouses can demand to see the ballots of their family members. Organizers can stand over the shoulders of seniors in nursing homes. Only the secret ballot in a voting booth insulates Americans from these peer influencers. It isn't good for anyone if Americans feel they need to hide their political views to protect themselves from scorn at home or from being fired at work. We need to reaffirm the First Amendment and the secret ballot. As I wrote in The Hill, we need to make it just as illegal to fire people because of their views as it is for Congress to put them in jail. We need to reestablish the norm that you are entitled, even encouraged, to say your political beliefs at home, at work, and on social media without penalty. Until we do that, don't expect that you can publicly ask folks how they voted and why, and get true answers. The current atmosphere, whether in the media, on campuses, or in the workplace, encourages at least some conservatives to remain in the closet. 38. Impressionable Elites Revisited. When I was chief strategist for Senator Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign in 2008, I noticed a consistent pattern. When someone came up to me and asked, "Why can't Hillary just be more likable?" it was invariably a donor or highly educated voter. When someone came up to me and asked if I thought her health care plan would work, it was invariably a middle or working class voter who had a genuine interest in the issue because it would affect his or her life. From this observation, I developed the theory of impressionable elites, meaning that contrary to expectations, the more educated our electorate becomes, the more swayed those educated voters become by what they hear and read from the sources they trust. Rather than thinking more independently, impressionable elites instead trust even more a chorus conducted by the media and think tanks. Middle and working class American voters, in contrast, are connected very closely in their everyday lives to the issues, and so they base their judgments not on talking points, but on the facts on the ground. This hypothesis is a hard one to test scientifically. But if anything, this propensity to pick up talking points uncritically from the media rather than base opinions on their own life experience, has grown even stronger in American life in the decades since the first microtrends covered impressionable elites. The elite establishment today in both parties is now under withering assault as fundamentally